Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Well, a remarkable thing has happened. You know, Rumi, the Persian poet Rumi, has been for a long time the best-selling poet in America. But not many people know very much about him, and I'd simply assumed, since he was born over 800 years ago, that there wasn't much left to know. Well, Brad Gooch, who has written biographies before this of Flannery O'Connor and of Frank O'Hara, has written a biography of Rumi that takes us from, what is it? What's the year?
Birth date, 1207, yeah. Dies in 1273, born in Central Asia in what's now Tajikistan, dies in what's now Turkey. So, you know, long life and a life that covered 2,500 miles also of traveling.
And manages somehow to invent a poetry so joyful, so given to ecstasy, that he is a predecessor of Whitman in certain aspects, in his melancholy, a predecessor of Emily Dickinson. So I think the most famous, you'll have to help me here, there is a field beyond...
Beyond right-doing and wrong-doing, I will meet you there. And that was Coleman Barks.
That's Coleman Barks' yeah. version. And I think one of the reasons it's so, so popular is it very much resembles a refrain from a Robert Frost poem about a field also that each verse ends, you come too. Mm-hmm. And we all like the invitational in our poetry. Right. And Rumi speaks directly to the reader.
Right. I mean, I think there's a kind of intimacy that's there in Rumi in the original and at any time, and that's what kind of comes across in these American translations, when you say Whitman, is this kind of IU, the way in which you can hear this voice across the eight centuries, and he's speaking to you in a fresh way. I mean, I think there's a way in which Rumi's almost translation proof. So I've read these very literary, scholarly translations. There are translations that are like beat poetry, and something about the voice of Rumi always comes through in this imagery and this longing and pain and then ecstasy.
And he's a love poet, a mystical love poet. And at a time when, with certain rare exceptions, we've almost forgotten how to write love poetry and how to receive it.
Right. And he sort of does two things at once. He uses a kind of romantic tradition of love poetry. So people read Rumi poems at their weddings all the time. And at the same time, these are poems to God and about spiritual love also. So you hear both at the same time.
Yes, I think all that's at the same time. Because the method is allegorical. Mm-hmm. He would look at his time, a Persian poet would look at the face of a beautiful boy in order to find evidence of divine beauty. Mm-hmm. And so there was a physical celebration as well as its representation of a celestial beauty that only divinity could account for.
Right, which helps both sides. I mean, divinizes beauty that you see around you, but also makes sort of the spiritual quest romantic. And I think that sort of grabs people in a way that the, Rumi said, the only religion for lovers is love. So the way in which it's an emotional sort of quest at the same time makes both exciting.
Now tell me, because I honestly have no idea, how does one go about writing a biography of someone who lived 800 years ago. Now, you traveled the 2,500 miles that Rumi traveled over his lifetime. Mm-hmm. Most of this travel, no longer possible for an American traveler.
Right. This is sort of a labor of love in a way, but I didn't quite think through the labor part of it. So this book took 8 years to do. Part of it was I needed to learn Persian. I kept smashing into contemporary geopolitics. I was in Syria in Aleppo in 2011 on the day that the civil war broke out, and much of what I was seeing has been destroyed. By now, I was taking a picture in Tehran of the wrong sign, and my camera was swiped away, and the official tried to get me to follow him into the Ministry of Justice. And in Tajikistan, going to the little village where we believe Rumi was born, on the way out was stopped by two cars with machine guns and taken 25 miles away to a kind of commissary where the local villager who had taken me to meet a poet who knew a lot about Rumi was chained to a pipe on the floor. So always this search for Rumi, which I think I imagined as a kind of mystical, slightly orientalist adventure, brought me into a lot of contemporary life and politics.
You know, Rumi, early in his life, is traveling with his family. His father was a spiritual teacher.
Yeah, I mean, traditional Muslim teacher, jurist with a mystical bent, but he came from a religious family. So much when he was 5 years old, he told his father that he was seeing angels, and his father then encouraged this and gave him some honorific names like Khodavan Degar and Jalaluddin, Glory of the Faith, but basically encouraged this kind of mystical bent in Rumi. And so he always loved his father and tried to follow in his path, although later in his life he outgrew it and became the sort of poet and raging mystic who we know. But also he lived through times that were even more challenging and chaotic than ours, if you can imagine. So that the the land of his childhood is completely wiped out by the terrorists of his time, the Mongols. And Baghdad, where you had the caliph who was both king and pope, is destroyed. The caliph this is during Rumi's lifetime, put in a sack and trampled with horses. And all the poets who were still alive from Baghdad would, you know, write these mournful poems and frightened poems, believing that this was the end of Islam, this was the end of this culture. And so Rumi was living then the second part of his life as a displaced person and a refugee.
Now, I'm talking to Brad Gooch, the author of Rumi's Secret. It's the life of the Sufi poet of love. There's been nothing of this completeness or complexity that's been done with Rumi before. It's published by Harper, who also do many translations of Rumi. It seemed as I was reading that Rumi, as he traveled, was being sensitized and resensitized to cultures until he arrives in Turkey. He's really about to start his life. Mm-hmm. He's going to be a teacher. He's going to be the head of a school. Mm-hmm. And a wandering poet appears and utterly changes his life. Mm-hmm. The epigraph to the book as a whole, let me see.
Want me to fill in for you?
Go ahead, please.
Love stole my prayer beads and gave me poetry and song.
Love stole my prayer beads and gave me poetry and song. And he becomes a dancing poet, a whirling poet. He becomes a singing poet.
Mm-hmm.
He stops being the kind of poet he had been. And, in fact, he's told by this shadowy figure to stop reading.
Mm-hmm.
To stop reading the poets he's been reading, to stop reading the work of his father, to follow his instincts.
Mm-hmm.
Who is this figure?
Right. I mean, one reason that I wanted to write the book was this figure, in a sense, the Rumi went through a midlife crisis, living the life that was set up for him by his father, being a kind of charismatic preacher at the time, having children, having posts in four different colleges. And then he's in his late 30s, and into town comes this itinerant mystic, Shams of Tabriz. Shams of Tabriz is 60 years old, and at this time he spent his life wandering around the Middle East studying with leading teachers such as probably Ibn Arabi and others. But if you were in central casting and you wanted to cast a spiritual leader, I don't think you would come up with Shams of Tabriz. I mean, he was a kind of eccentric and irascible and misanthropic character who didn't suffer fools lightly. He was very interested in Rumi and not in anyone else, which caused a lot of anxiety in Rumi's life and his family and his school. They would go into seclusion first for 3 months, then for 6 months together, and all of this led to a lot of upset, chaos, and dissension.
Well, it wasn't the first time for Rumi traveling with his father.
Mm-hmm.
Often as not, a mystic or poet or teacher would say, the father's pretty good, but look at little Rumi. He's like an ocean behind a lake.
Mm-hmm.
And Rumi's face was apparently full of light.
Mm-hmm.
And Shams sees him, sees his light. They exchange looks, and this gruff, very unpleasant-seeming man becomes a teacher, lover, beloved. There's no indication that there was a sexual consummation, but they spent all their time together.
Mm-hmm.
They sequestered themselves with one another.
Mm-hmm.
They saw no others.
Mm-hmm.
His children, Rumi's children, were allowed occasional visitation nights. His wife appeared without her veil on, which mm-hmm. was very, very rare in that culture. And what we have, it seems, is one of the incredible historical literary love stories.
Right.
Because Shams knows that the culture Rumi lives in will not accept him,
mm-hmm.
will not accept them,
mm-hmm.
that he's not the well-trained,
mm-hmm.
articulate, university-bred ivory tower man
mm-hmm. right.
who's so liked, who can be given a university appointment.
Mm-hmm.
He's a thug.
Well, not a thug, but definitely an outsider.
He's brilliant, but he behaves like a thug, yeah?
Okay, yeah. Or extreme bohemian of the time. But, you know, always trying to, and also to shatter Rumi's decorum. I mean, he was using scandal in a way to try to free Rumi. I mean, his, you know, in the beginning months, it was getting Rumi to move from a path of knowledge to a path of love and the heart, and away from writing sermons and fatwas to writing poetry. And then Rumi, and then Shams teaches him the whirling dance that becomes the center of Rumi's meditation. There was something about their relationship and the love that they had for each other that was extremely challenging at the time. And this was in the midst of a culture. It was completely normal, this idea of a shahed, where a mystic or a Sufi teacher would look at the face of the student and in a kind of Plato-Socrates model, teach the student, and also that this beauty was somehow connected to learning almost, and the connection of knowledge and eros. But Rumi and Shams were not, first of all, that Rumi was already a religious teacher, established. And people had great trouble because there was a back and forth between them, almost someone called it reciprocal ethic of love. So, and they were not used to this. Even Shams would say at one point, I have to know, are we student and teacher? Or are we friend and companion? Or are we lover and beloved? Rumi said that someone in town had said, we can't tell who's the lover and who is the beloved. So even in a culture in which there was, a fluidity about these kinds of companionships between men, Shams of Tabriz and Rumi had what seems to us a very modern kind of reciprocity in their way. And the love between them was very palpable and was the shock that allowed Rumi to transform eventually from this success story within his culture to a poet and mystic.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Brad Gooch about his book, Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Brad Gooch about his new biography, Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Famed 13th Century Persian Sufi Poet. Shams leaves temporarily, and Rumi experiences an almost biological need for him. Then, fortunately, it's discovered that there's a place where they can send letters, and Rumi sends a bunch of the love poems that he's
sort
been
of
writing.
Letter poems to Shams to try to convince him to return. And this is really when Rumi begins writing poetry. I mean, all the poems that we know are written after Rumi is 40 years old, right? Including 3,000 Ghazal, 2,000 Rubaiyat, a 6-volume spiritual epic. So all of this comes out of the relationship with Shams of Tabriz and also the separation.
And Shams comes back, but briefly, and then he leaves, disappears. Was he murdered? Possibly. No one knows. He disappears, and what Rumi discovers is that love is universal, that it's not just Shams he loves, it's the spirit of love itself. And he writes a poem that I'm going to ask Brad to read, because I believe it's your translation,
yes?
Which is about that changeability, how you can find a depth of love, that love is what you're seeking, not a lover.
Right. Last year in a red cloak, he rose like the moon, only to return this year in blue. The Turk you saw last year in Turkestan returned this year as an Arab. The same beloved, but in different clothes, he changed his clothes and then he reappeared. The wine is the same, but in a different glass.
That last line is, it seems, a typical Rumi touch, and perhaps something that happens in Persian poetry. A metaphor arrives to describe the whole of the experience. The wine is the same, but in a different glass. Some of these are more heartbreaking. This is a poem that Rumi writes when he's getting over heartbreak, when he's realizing that his life is no longer without love. Now tell me, Brent, once Shams was gone, did this return him to his children, his wife, his family?
So his first reaction to Shams of Tabriz's departure is a kind of a meltdown. And then he tries to come out of it, and he really uses poetry, in a sense, to make a connection with Shams of Tabriz, to work out his divine love and human love in some way. And he does it in ways that are moving and fascinating to go through. I mean, he really, first of all, there's a tradition in Persian poetry called the Takhalos, where the poet uses his name in the last line of the poem as a kind of tag. Rumi starts using Shams of Tabriz as his Takhalos. And so when these poems are first collected, they're called the collective poems of Shams of Tabriz. So this isn't, he's not just saying that Shams influenced or inspired them, but that he is writing these poems through Rumi. And for a while, he goes off searching for Shams for about a year. He's mainly in Damascus. And there he has not just a poetic breakthrough, but also a mystical breakthrough where he realizes, why am I looking outside myself? Shams of Tabriz is within myself. The love I was looking for is within me.
We come to understand the aspects of Islamic culture.
Mm-hmm.
Let's remember, this is a culture that gives us a great deal of our mathematics,
mm-hmm.
numbers themselves, in fact, Arabic numbers. It gives us astronomy and ideas about the physical universe, mm-hmm. and its mathematics, its harmonies, its triangular pivots. And an intelligent religious person trained to teach also knows astronomy, philosophy, mathematics, geometry, geography. He's
right.
trained in all of the fields. And so implicitly, when we read Rumi, we're reading about what his culture knows about the universe,
mm-hmm.
what it assumes, and what it needs to learn to disregard mm-hmm. in order to achieve ecstatic communion with the spiritual. Yeah?
Right. Yeah, so Rumi has this well-tempered computer in his in his brain that it's been prepared through his entire life. It reminded me a little of Frank O'Hara, who I wrote a biography of before, in the sense that O'Hara had been to Harvard. He had read everything that existed. So did Jack Kerouac, for instance. But there were poets who then sort of climbed to a certain point and then pushed the ladder away. And Rumi very much does that. And so you see in his poetry, I mean, Quranic references constantly. He'd obviously seemed to have memorized the Quran and uses phrases and lines, but also astronomy and mathematics, and all these references are there. At the same time, he's very interested in communicating, and then he's using poetry. When he finally accepts his insight and position, he becomes a teacher again, but instead of sermons, he's using poetry, really, to teach, and, you know, very much a popular mode of poetry, and using rhyme and rhythm and song to communicate these feelings and ideas.
As I was reading the book, I was very excited to learn so much, not just about Rumi and his love, because I'm a sucker for a love story. I mean, this is one of the great unrequited
right.
love stories. He never finds Shams again.
Right.
There, from time to time, he hears about a peddler, say, selling sugared fruit and wonders if that might be Shams.
Mm.
He goes running off or sends messengers to look, but never finds him.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the forms of love is unrequited love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the forms of love of God is unrequited love
right.
as well. You know, it's sort of, if you pray to God and you say you didn't get an answer, well, in certain cases you did get an answer.
Mm-hmm.
The answer was no.
Right.
In this case, Rumi is writing ecstatic no poetry.
No, it's true. And it's also, I mean, Rumi was not alone. I mean, he was in a culture that had this sort of spirituality. But there is a sense in which, for all his, you know, he's a great antidepressant in a certain way, as you're talking about. There's all this joy in Rumi. At the center of it is the pain of separation. And this is his central theme, and its separation from Shams of Tabriz, but also the human condition as feeling separated from God and seeking reunion.
In addition to your own biography, if you were to recommend a particular or some particular translations of Rumi mm-hmm. that you feel are representative of what Rumi could do, what would you recommend?
Well, I think there are W.S. Merwin translations that are wonderful. There's also an Everyman edition that Knopf publishes that is a selection of a potpourri of different translators. And I usually recommend that to people to begin with because they're sort of the best of these different types of translations, from Arbery and Nicholson, who are the Orientalist scholars, to Coleman Barks and Kabir Helminski and different contemporary poet translators. Also, I've been, you know, with Mariam Mortaz, who collaborated with me in the translation, I've been doing, have a Twitter feed, Rumi Secrets, where I tweet Rumi lines. And so that's
every day.
So that, yes.
Where does one go?
At Rumi Secrets.
That's the Twitter site. It's a good way to start a day, isn't it?
It's a wonderful way to start a day. And also, you know, Persian poetry works in lines. Even the critics of that time would say it's a string of pearls, basically, that every line is a pearl, not so much to build to a crescendo, but that each line would be perfect. So, you know, the 140 characters of Twitter work with a Rumi Persian line of poetry. So it's great.
I've been talking with Brad Gooch, author of Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love, published by Harper. Thank you, Brad, for joining me.
This was wonderful.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Rumi's Secret at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director today is Kat Yore. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Morgan Parker is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.